This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Donald Fagen was the co-founder of one of the more successful pop groups of the 70s, Steely Dan. Fagen was the pianist and lead singer. He co-wrote the songs with his partner, guitarist Walter Becker. Steely Dan's hits included Ricky Don't Lose That Number, Reelin' in the Years, Peg, and FM. The band rarely toured, and Fagen and Becker seldom gave interviews. They went their separate ways in 1981. Since then, Fagen has made one solo album and has written some film music. Now he has a new album called The New York Rock and Soul Review, Live at the Beacon. The record features performers like Michael McDonald, Phoebe Snow, and Boz Scaggs doing their versions of rock and soul classics like Knock on Wood and Lonely Teardrops. Fagen and McDonald perform the Steely Dan tune, Pretzel Logic. Get the idea for the New York Rock and Soul Review?
A friend of mine, Libby Titus, was producing some club concerts and shows in restaurants around Manhattan, and she asked me if I'd like to do a couple of those small concerts. So I hadn't been getting much of an opportunity to play, so I did a few of those things, and that finally expanded into a more miscellaneous sort of soul show. And then finally we mixed in some contemporary stuff and got some big stars and ended up doing a show at the Beacon Theater in 1990 and then repeated it in 1991 with a slightly different cast. And that's the shows that were recorded.
You said you hadn't been getting many opportunities to play. Had you wanted more opportunities to play?
I spent most of the 80s not really performing, and I guess I'd spent so many years in the studio, I felt like I wanted to get out and play some, and this was, you know, a good opportunity to do it in a kind of low-pressure situation.
What made you want to get out and perform as opposed to being in the studio?
Well, Nightfly record, which was my solo record, came out in 1980 or 81, and I kind of went into a writer's block for the first half of the 80s, and I was looking for alternative things to do until I was, you know, felt I was inspired to write. So I took some other jobs, doing some music for movies and some production work. And I also did some writing, actually, for Premiere Magazine. I was doing a film music column. What I'd rather have been doing was playing. So when the opportunity came along, I took it.
One of the performers on the new record is formerly of the Young Rascals.
Mm-hmm.
And he does Groovin'.
Right.
Old friend of yours? Or were you an old fan of the Rascals?
Yeah, I'm a big Rascals fan. I think New Yorkers are very attached to the Rascals. I've said before, I think that if there was ever a New York local band that typified New York, I think it was the Rascals. They had a kind of very up soul sound that was very original with them, they were real authentic white soul singers, and they had a string of hits in the 60s, which are still very popular around town here. And people loved the Rascals. They were a fantastic live band in their time that were known far and wide as being the most exciting band you could possibly see in a club. And so when we were putting this together, we wanted to get as many Rascals as we could. We only ended up with Eddie and his brother, but maybe someday we'll get some more Rascals as well.
Donald Fagen is my guest. Since on your new record you pay homage to songs and performers who you like a lot, I'm interested in your musical biography. What kind of music did you grow up listening to growing up in, I think it was Passaic, New Jersey?
Let's see. My mother was a dance band singer from the age of 5 till, I guess, about 17. She used to sing in the Catskills.
You were 5. She wasn't 5, right? Yeah.
She was 5, right. Yeah. Yeah, no, she was. She started at 5 years old and doing shows up in the Catskills. Her, she was kind of a local Borscht Belt child star. And she worked every summer until she was 17. So she knew, every possible standard, and she had a very nice kind of back phrasing, swing-type phrasing style. And she used to sing around the house, during my childhood, so I knew all the basic standards. And then when I was about 8 or 9 years old, quite young, I had some older cousins who turned me on to jazz, and I was kind of a weenie jazz fan. And that's, I collected jazz and became, very, very involved with not only the music, but the cultural realities of jazz and how it differed from my middle class background. I think, like a lot of white middle class kids, black music was, and its culture was an alternative. I think, like a lot of kids, I found something missing in the American childhood. And, jazz was, in a way, saved me.
So how old were you when you were able to go into the city to jazz clubs?
Well, my cousins who were in high school used to take me in to the city when I was 10 or 11 years old. I remember sitting in the kiddie section of the Vanguard.
They had a kiddie section?
Well, they said, we'll put you in the kiddie section. What it actually was the... banquettes along the wall, right next to where they used to have the drum kit. And I remember at 11 years old sitting right next to Danny Richmond, who was playing with Charlie Mingus, and having my glass of Coca-Cola vibrate towards the edge of the table from the power of his drumming, and have to keep moving my glass back towards the middle of the table.
So how did you discover or rediscover rock and soul and rhythm and blues?
Well, I think in the mid-60s, 65, which is the year I went to college up at Bard College in Annandale, New York, jazz had changed quite a bit, or was in the process of changing into a more, really a more political music because of the what was going on in the country culturally as far as black and white. And at the same time, I felt that I couldn't relate to the music as well as I had done. And at the same time, I discovered blues and soul music, which had, I think, I also had a lot of the political feeling and, in fact, political relevance about them, but I could relate to it more easily. And it had a kind of directness which I was looking for at that time. And, it was unfamiliar music to me, but it had a lot of the kind of soul that I had always heard in jazz, and it just attracted me. And I also liked a lot of the white rock bands that were around at the time.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Donald Fagen, formerly of Steely Dan, and he has a new record called the New York Rock and Soul Review. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Donald Fagen. In the 1970s, he and Walter Becker formed the band Steely Dan. Here's the song Dr. Wu from their album Katie Lied.
Katie tried, I was halfway crucified. I was on the other side of no tomorrow. You walked in and my life began again. Just when I'd spent the last piaster I could borrow. All night long, we would sing that stupid song. And every word we sang I knew was true. Are you with me, Dr. Wu? Are you really?
You and Walter Becker met when you were both in college.
Mm-hmm.
You started to play together then?
Yeah, I had a band at that time, I guess it was about 66, 67, and Walter was, I guess he was came in a couple of years after I did, and I heard him practicing the guitar one day, and I asked him to join the band.
The band that you and Walter Becker formed in college was not called Steely Dan, was it?
No, we had, you know, a million different, you know, bad names.
Oh, let's hear some.
I'm trying to think back. I think, you know, one time we were toying with the Leather Canary.
You know, what does that mean?
I'm not sure, but those were the years, you know, that
right.
That you know, odd metaphors and seemed to be the thing to do. And that band didn't work out, but we did continue writing songs together. And after college, we continued to work together.
Whose idea was naming the band Steely Dan? Had you read a lot of William Burroughs fiction?
Yeah, Walter and I were both Burroughs fans, and we needed a name in a hurry, and this was about 1971. We'd already started recording an album, and we thought that this was kind of a funny in-joke to call it Steely Dan, which is a sexual device, which is mentioned in kind of cartoon sexual device, which is mentioned in Naked Lunch by William Burroughs. And, of course, we thought that this band would last about 6 months and that we'd, you know, then go on to something else. I think probably if we had thought about it, we would have come up with something more original.
Well, did you ever feel, once everybody found out what Steely Dan meant, did you ever feel stuck with a name that you didn't want anymore?
In a way, but, you know, it kind of, by that time, it sort of meant something else, so...
Right, it meant the band.
Yeah, so, you know, apologies to William Burroughs.
Now, before you and Walter Becker formed Steely Dan, you were part of the backup group for Jay and the Americans, whose hits included Only in America, She Cried, Come a Little Bit Closer, Caramia. Now, you toured with them in 70 and 71. They had their last record on the chart in 1970, so this was the decline period for Jay and the Americans. I mean, let's face it, you know, psychedelic music was in, Jay and the Americans was out at that time. So what was it like to tour with a band that had a lot of hits but was on the way down?
Yeah, they were on a declining curve, no doubt. And but for us, it was great because it was a job playing music with a professional group, and it was our really I think that was our earliest experience of doing real touring, and we got a lot of experience as you know, with how to keep a rhythm section tight, how to play together, and. We had a lot of fun in that group because we didn't have any responsibility. There were four guys in monkey suits standing in front of us, and it made it very very easy and fun.
Did you like the band's music?
Well, you know, it wasn't really our cup of tea, but you know, if you play music, any kind of music, if it has a good groove, it's fun to play. It really doesn't matter what it is.
You went out to Los Angeles with Walter Becker to become staff writers for ABC Records.
Right.
Describe what the job was like as a staff writer.
staff writing was a great job. We were probably among the very last staff writers ever hired by a record company, which was definitely the idea of having staff writers was on its way out. But we had a little room with a piano in it, and every day we'd come in at 9 o'clock to the our little studio and try to write pop songs for the artists on the label. And it was fun. Unfortunately, Walter and I are probably among the worst pop song writers ever. our songs tended to be imitative of other pop songs, and we were basically writing on order for groups like the Grassroots. There was a few other groups we tried to write for who were on the label, I guess Three Dog Night, but none of them ever actually recorded any of our songs. I think Denny Daugherty, formerly with the Mamas and Papas, did one, but I don't think it was ever released.
Were you writing lyrics as cryptic for the Grassroots as you later wrote for your own group?
Well, we tried to, you know, that was another problem. We tried to write lyrics that, were less personal and you know, more universal and more romantic. But generally, that was another element that was made them sort of easy to resist by the by the commercial pop singers.
Do you remember any lyrics that you could tell?
Well,
us?
You know, I remember trying to interest some of the mainstream pop groups during a song called "Proud to Be Your Slave."
How did that go?
I remember it had a kind of Carole King type of feeling about it, but you know, it was the lyrics just got more and more perverse as they went on, and we just couldn't help ourselves. So we realized we had to get a band together if we were going to actually do any recording.
So did "Proud to Be Your Slave" did that help lead to Steely Dan?
You know, we had our own book of songs that were more personal and had, I think, expressed a kind of our sense of humor and our sort of attitude. And these songs were songs that we would never try to pawn off on anyone else. It was things that we knew we had to do with our own group. And it was this book of songs that we basically used for the Steely Dan group.
Why did Steely Dan become more of a studio band than a touring band, especially given that you and Walter Becker had, you know, gotten your start playing as the backup band for Jay and the Americans? So you had experience being on the road, playing very different music, but being on the road.
Mm-hmm. Well, the band was put together very quickly, the same way the title, the name of the band was chosen. We basically started recording with a five-man group that were recruited mostly from studio players that we had played with in the East Coast. And for years we'd been looking for a singer that could be a front man and, who had a what we at the time thought of as a true singing voice. And we'd never been able to find one. At the last moment, we brought in a guy named Dave Palmer, who one of the other guys knew, and we started recording the record with him singing. But everyone seemed to agree that the attitude we were trying to express was really lost. It was something very personal. So I was elected as being able to, sing the most in tune. And, between Walter and I, my pitch was a little better, and I had the right attitude, so I became the front man. And in fact, professional record I ever recorded was Do It Again, which became a big hit.
You think of the singer as being the front man?
Certainly on stage, there was no one else willing to do it, really. So by default, I became the singer and the front man.
Were you uncomfortable with this new position?
Well, yes and no. I didn't like the pressure. I had an untrained voice, and my voice would get tired by the end of a night of singing for like an hour and a half and in front of a big, noisy rock and roll band. And you know, I enjoyed performing and I enjoyed playing, but the singing and the and especially talking to the audience was new to me, and it was difficult for me. I'm basically was a shy kid, and it was a little hard for me, hard going for me.
For you, it must have been hard when the band broke up because you were used to writing songs in a collaborative relationship, you know, in partnership with with Walter Becker.
You mean when Walter and I split up?
Yeah.
Well, that was, yeah, that was later on in about 80. And, yeah, it was very difficult for both of us. But I think we had both agreed that we had run out of some kind of energy by that time, and we just needed a vacation from each other.
How did that work out for you? Did that coincide with your period of writer's block breaking up?
Well, I had this album I wanted to do, which is basically autobiographical, and I knew I'd have to do that myself, and that turned into The Nightfly.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think it was after The Nightfly when I felt that I needed to take some time, and I would work every day, but I just didn't like what I was writing. And it seemed either repetitive or I would write something one day and then 2 days later I'd play it back and just didn't like the way it sounded. And I think it was really, it had to do with my life. And, you know, I was in my 30s by then, and I think I just needed to do some self-analysis and sit out a few years and do some other things to sort of get back some kind of creative energy.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Nice talking to you.
Donald Fagen is working on a new album of his own songs. He co-wrote some with Walter Becker, who's also producing the album.